Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to Washington Today for March 14th, 2022. I'm Gary Sarikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us. At the United Nations today, Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that nuclear war is back in the realm of possibility and spoke about how Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine could escalate. We'll hear the Secretary General's comments and more from the UN meeting coming up. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will speak virtually to members of Congress on Wednesday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced in a joint letter. The letter stated, quote, "The Congress remains unwavering in our commitment to supporting Ukraine as they face Russian President Vladimir Putin's cruel and diabolical aggression and to passing legislation to cripple and isolate the Russian economy, as well as deliver humanitarian, security, and economic assistance to Ukraine." His address is scheduled at 9 a.m. on Wednesday. You can hear President Zelensky right here on C-SPAN Radio. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said today that he opposes the nomination of Sarah Bloom Raskin to a key position on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, endangering her prospects of winning Senate confirmation. Banking Committee Republicans, led by Ranking Member Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, have opposed Raskin because she's been an outspoken supporter of having the Fed consider the threat of climate change in its regulation of the banks. President Biden nominated Raskin to serve as the Fed's vice chair for supervision, which is a top regulatory post. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve is expected to raise borrowing costs as a part of its efforts to slow growth and tame high inflation. According to the Associated Press, quote, "With a war raging in Europe and price increases at a four-decade high, Fed Chair Jerome Powell will seek to engineer a soft landing, a gradual slowdown in economic activity that helps curb surging prices while keeping the job market and economy expanding. As a first step, the Fed will make a quarter-point increase in its lending rate. It's slated to be the first of several rate hikes this year." And 49 of the 50 Republican senators said today they would not back a new nuclear deal between Iran and world powers. Citing press reports about a new deal, which has yet to be finalized, the lawmakers said in a statement that they pledged to do everything in their power to reverse an agreement that does not completely block Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon, constrain its ballistic missile program, and confronts Iran's support for terrorism. We begin in New York City, where the United Nations Security Council met to receive a briefing from Zbigniew Rau, Poland's foreign minister and the head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Before the meeting, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres talked to the media about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, calling nuclear war back within the realm of possibility. His comments come following Russian President Putin's orders to put his country's nuclear forces on high alert. Mr. Putin has blamed his move on NATO and economic sanctions imposed by Western countries. Here is Secretary General Guterres.
"Raising the alert of Russian nuclear forces is a bone-chilling development. The prospect of nuclear conflict, once unthinkable, is now back within the realm of possibility. The security and safety of nuclear facilities must also be preserved. It's time to stop the horror unleashed on the people of Ukraine and get on the path of diplomacy and peace. I've been in close contact with a number of countries, including China, France, Germany, India, Israel, and Turkey, on mediation efforts to bring an end to this war. The appeals for peace must be heard. This tragedy must stop. It's never too late for diplomacy and dialogue. We need an immediate cessation of hostilities and serious negotiations based on the principles of the UN Charter and international law. We need peace. Peace for the people of Ukraine. Peace for the world. We need peace now."
The Secretary General also talked about the war's global impacts, saying that the world must act to prevent a, quote, hurricane of hunger and a meltdown of the global food system that could have a devastating impact on the poorest nations.
I will continue to highlight the desperate plight of the people of Ukraine as I'm doing again today. Yet, there is another dimension of this conflict that gets obscured. This war goes far beyond Ukraine. It is also an assault on the world's most vulnerable people and countries. While war reigns over Ukraine, a sword of Damocles hangs over the global economy, especially in the developing world. Even before the conflict, developing countries were struggling to recover from the pandemic with record inflation, rising interest rates, and looming debt burdens. Their ability to respond has been erased by exponential increases in the cost of financing. Now, their breadbasket is being bombed. Russia and Ukraine represent more than half of the world's supply of sunflower oil and about 30% of the world's wheat. Ukraine alone provides more than half of the world's food program's wheat supply. Food, fuel, and fertilizer prices are skyrocketing. Supply chains are being disrupted, and the costs and delays of transportation of imported goods when available are at record levels. And all of this is hitting the poorest, the hardest, and planting the seeds for political instability and unrest around the globe.
Secretary General Guterres was speaking on the sidelines of today's Security Council briefing, which featured a message from Poland's Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau. He also heads the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE. He talked about how Russia's invasion was meant to erode the growing economic cooperation between European countries.
Will we be able to achieve progress on regional and protracted conflicts when trust has been shattered? I very much hope so, but it will require acting in good faith on the part of all parties, including Russia. The same applies to the renewed European security dialogue which the Polish chair initiated in response to growing tensions. Supported by an overwhelming majority of the participating states, it was meant to develop new measures of trust, transparency, and confidence. Unfortunately, despite initial interest, the Russian side has chosen the most destructive path of confronting its concerns, fears, and misgivings. The changing situation on the ground will probably determine the scope and character of the future engagement of a special monitoring mission in Ukraine. Acknowledging the mission's 8 years of operation and its expertise, I will work with the OSCE structures and participating states to utilize its potential in the future. I hope that both the mission-dedicated staff as well as the team of the OSCE project coordinator in Ukraine will be able to continue their important mission.
Foreign Minister Rau added that he would soon travel to Moldova, which borders Ukraine, and the Balkan countries, which border Russia and are part of the NATO alliance, to show OSCE's engagement in helping end the war. Also at the UN today, reaction to the death of American journalist Brent Raynaud, who was killed by Russian forces outside the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv as he was traveling to film refugees. Here's U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the U.N. Richard Mills speaking about it at today's Security Council meeting.
I'd like to begin by expressing our outrage over the death of journalist Brent Raynaud, who was killed by Russian forces while covering refugees leaving a checkpoint at Irpin yesterday. According to his colleagues, Mr. Raynaud was in the area because he understood the critical role independent media has played in providing objective coverage of Russia's war of choice against Ukraine. His death shows that Russia will go to any extent to silence narratives that challenge its propaganda. And it underscores the importance of upholding the safety of journalists as they undertake their important work. Excuse me. Last year, at this meeting, on cooperation between the UN and the OC, the United States recalled that we had just passed the 7th anniversary of Russia's invasion and occupation of Crimea and the launch of its aggression in eastern Ukraine. We noted that in those 7 years, the Russian-fueled conflict in eastern Ukraine had killed more than 13,000 people and wounded tens of thousands more. And we warned that Russia's aggression was far from over. It had been less than 3 weeks since Russia launched a major invasion against the rest of Ukraine. During these 3 weeks, Russia unleashed horrific devastation against another UN member state, resulting in the death of thousands and the displacement of over 2.5 million people. Russia must immediately cease all hostilities, withdraw its forces from Ukraine, and take the path of diplomacy, in keeping with the principles of the UN Charter and the Helsinki Final Act. Mr. President, Russia's further invasion of Ukraine is an unprecedented challenge, a challenge to the post-World War II European security order and to cooperation between all of us.
That's U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Richard Mills. The State Department has offered its sincerest condolences and assistance to Reynaud's family. Brent Reynaud and his brother Craig have reported from a number of global hotspots over the past two decades, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and Egypt, according to a biography on their website. The pair won a Peabody Award in 2015 for an 8-part documentary for Vice News about a school in Chicago for students with severe emotional issues. And late word today that Fox News reporter Benjamin Hall was wounded outside of Kyiv, the network said. Fox News anchor John Roberts read a statement on the air from network CEO Suzanne Scott, revealing that Benjamin Hall had been wounded in Ukraine and remained hospitalized. The letter reads in part, quote, earlier today, our correspondent Benjamin Hall was injured while news gathering outside of Kyiv in Ukraine. We have a minimal level of details right now, but Ben is hospitalized and our teams on the ground are working to gather additional information as the situation quickly unfolds. The safety of our entire team of journalists in Ukraine and the surrounding regions is our top priority and of the utmost importance. This is a stark reminder for all journalists who are putting their lives on the line every day to deliver the news from a war zone. U.S. officials have said China will face harsh consequences if it aids Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. It comes after U.S. officials told a number of newspapers that Russia has asked China for military equipment. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has called that U.S. disinformation. Here's State Department spokesman Ned Price responding to a question about it from Associated Press reporter Matt Lee.
Yesterday, administration officials were expressing concern that about a Russian request to China for military assistance in their Ukraine invasion. I know that Jake Sullivan met with Yang Jiechi earlier in Rome, and the White House will have more to say about this later. But I'm wondering if, in the meantime, you have gotten any indication that this has gone, that this request that you say has been made, has been met with any kind of a response, either positive or negative, by the Chinese?
Well, Matt, to your question, we haven't spoken to this and not going to comment specifically on these reports. What I can say broadly, however, and you alluded to this, is the fact that our national security advisor, who's accompanied by our assistant secretary for the region, Dan Crittenbrink, is in Rome today, where they met with Yang Jiechi and his delegation from the PRC. The National Security Advisor and our delegation raised directly and very clearly our concerns about the PRC's support to Russia in the wake of the invasion and the implications that any such support would have for the PRC's relationship not only with us, but for its relationships around the world. That includes our allies and partners in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific. Beyond that, I'm just not in a position to get into the details, but the purpose of this meeting, and you will hear more from the White House later today, I expect, was to convey very clearly our concerns and to discuss the implications.
Okay, but you said that you raised, I'll go back and look here, but you said that you raised your concerns about Chinese support for. So does that mean that you think that they already are supporting?
I am not confirming anything from here. What I will say is that we are watching very closely the extent to which the PRC, or any other country for that matter, provides any form of support, whether that's material support, whether that's economic support, whether that's financial support, to Russia. Any such support from anywhere in the world would be of great concern to us. It would be of course, the greatest concern if a country like the PRC were to be doing that, a country that, by the way, has tremendous leverage with Russia, has a relationship with Russia that is distinct from the relationship that we or just about any other country on the planet has with Russia. And with that in mind, could do more than probably many other countries to bring an end to this senseless violence, to this brutality, to Putin's premeditated war of choice. We have communicated very clearly to Beijing that we won't stand by if we will not allow any country to compensate Russia for its losses.
State Department spokesman Ned Price speaking at today's briefing. And more information coming in today on Russia's missile attack on a Ukrainian military base near the Poland border. The attack Sunday in Yavoriv in western Ukraine, which is about 15 miles from NATO territory, reportedly did not disrupt shipments of Western military aid, despite Russia's claims to the contrary. With more, here's Pentagon spokesman John Kirby.
So, again, without getting into too much tactical detail, Jen, I mean, this was clearly a Russian airstrike. Our understanding is that these were cruise missiles fired from aircraft long range on the Yavoriv training facility there in western Ukraine. I can assure you that there were no U.S. military personnel there at that training facility. That's where the Florida National Guard had been doing their training before they left a few weeks ago. No U.S. contractors there, no U.S. Civilians, no government U.S. government personnel there at all. As for the damage done, we know that several structures were hit. We don't have a perfect picture of what the damage was done or how much gear or equipment was hit and with what effect. But as we've said before, this is now the third significant strike in western Ukraine. It certainly appears as if the Russians are broadening their target set.
Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. Thousands of U.S. troops have been sent to Poland and other countries along the NATO alliance's eastern edge. Over the weekend, intelligence officials from both the U.S. and the United Kingdom warned that Russia could use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Western allies have accused President Putin of planning a false flag operation, which would use a false claim that Ukraine has such weapons as an excuse for Russia to deploy its own. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the strategy as the same one that Russian-backed Bashar al-Assad used for carrying out chemical attacks during the civil war in Syria. Now, C-SPAN spoke with Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security senior scholar Gigi Gronewall about Russia's possible use of chemical and biological weapons in Ukraine.
So Russia was accused by the United States just a couple of years ago of having a biological and weapons program. We are not, no nation is supposed to have a biological weapons program. They are a signatory of the Biological Weapons Convention, which prohibits that. But they have been suspected of being a violator for some time, and then they were accused by the U.S. formally, and then now, of course, the United States is talking very plainly about it. Biological weapons programs are not as resource intensive as nuclear programs, for example. And so, you know, and there's just very little that's available outside of, you know, that's publicly available to know what kind of program Russia indeed has. So as far as, you know, we can talk about what they used to have before back in the 90s, when before they renounced them or said they renounced them. But we don't really know what they could have.
What is the difference between biological and chemical? How do they work?
Sure. So biological, we're bacteria, viruses, fungi. Those are all biological organisms. And even though there is a lot of work that's done across the world for peaceful purposes to better understand them, so that, you know, we can help cure disease, it's possible to use those as weapons as well. And so that is the biological side. The chemical side is a little bit more fuzzy because a lot of chemicals are used for are allowed for a variety of industrial purposes and riot control agents, et cetera. But there is a list that that is prohibited of chemicals that are prohibited under the Chemical Weapons Convention.
So there are international agreements.
Yes, there are definitely international agreements. The Biological Weapons Convention went into force in 1975, and the Chemical Weapons Convention was in the 90s. But it is definitely not allowed to use those in warfare.
And who agreed? Which countries?
Most nations in the world. There's 183 member states to the Biological Weapons Convention and 193 to the Chemical Weapons Convention. So that's most of everyone. And then there's also a UN Security Council resolution called UN Security Council Resolution 1540, which made nations do things so that they can discourage any non-state actor or terrorist use of chemical or biological weapons.
Did Russia agree? Did they sign those agreements?
Yes, they did. This has been a problem with Russia in the past during the Soviet days. It was not too long after smallpox was eradicated that that they started growing tons of it for weapons. They had, you know, they were illegally growing tons of anthrax and putting them into bombs, et cetera. So that was what we know was the case back in the 80s and 90s.
And what was the use of these types of weapons by Russia in Syria?
Thankfully, to my knowledge, biological weapons were not used in Syria, but chemical weapons, of course, have been. There have been other indicators that Russia has been developing other chemical weapons. Of course, we all, the reason we know about Novichok is because Russia wanted us to know about Novichok in the UK. And so, right after 2002, I believe, was the theater use of fentanyl compounds. So it's they definitely have a diverse array of chemical weapons.
What worries you about their capabilities?
You know, I think, you know, states have a lot of options at their disposal. I worry more about a state using these weapons and eroding the norms that have so far protected, at least on the biological side, against their use. But you know, there are many worrisome things about this situation. This is one of many.
Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security senior scholar Gigi Groenvall from this morning's Washington Journal program. You can see the entire segment at cspan.org and on the C-SPAN Now video app. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. Former President Obama has tested positive for COVID-19. He says he has a scratchy throat, but otherwise feels okay. He tweeted that Michelle and I are grateful to be vaccinated and boosted, and she has tested negative. It's a reminder to get vaccinated if you haven't already, even as cases go down. More than 80 House Democrats have sent a letter to President Biden asking him to restart negotiations on the climate portions of his Build Back Better plan. The letter urges the president to support a package that would cut U.S. global warming pollution by nearly half by 2030, while building out the clean energy industry and reducing energy costs. Democrats who signed on to the letter include members of the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, 15 Democrats on the Energy and Commerce Committee, 6 committee chairs, 24 members of the New Democrat Coalition, and 48 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Virginia Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, has publicly acknowledged for the first time that she participated in the January 6, 2021 Stop the Steal rally on the Ellipse. That was the event that preceded the storming of the Capitol by a pro-Donald Trump mob. In an interview with the conservative Washington Free Beacon, Ms. Thomas said she was at the rally for a short period of time, got cold, and went home before the former president took the stage. She told the Free Beacon that she, quote, was disappointed and frustrated that there was violence and happened following a peaceful gathering of Trump supporters on the Ellipse on January 6th. The World Bank has announced it's offering to close offering $1 billion to help Ukraine's social services. World Bank President David Malpass told a virtual event that was hosted by The Washington Post that the bank hoped to finalize a $3 billion package of support within 6 to 8 weeks to help Ukraine cover its needs.
So I had first gone to Ukraine in 2019 and saw an economy that was in transition. The World Bank has a large program there. So when the war struck, we wanted to find a way to accelerate some parts of that program. We've done that. So we've taken multiple steps. One is to our own funds, we've been able to begin the disbursements. We actually made disbursements last week of $325 million, and we have a press release going out today showing that we now have $923 million that's been made available over the last 2 weeks, including that first disbursement for Ukraine. This is cash that the government can use to pay current services, which are in such demand in Ukraine, of government workers, for example, and pensions and support that's much needed. And the key element here is the ability to disperse quickly. One of the challenges for the world during crises is there are pledges made, but turning those pledges into actual commitments and disbursements is a challenge. That was very much true of the COVID crisis and the vaccines, where there were many more pledges than there were actual delivery of funds or of vaccines. So we're trying to counter that, or be very forthcoming in Ukraine with World Bank money. And with other donors' money, we were able to announce today the addition of funding from donors through a trust fund that we set up last week. And so it can be fast acting. We've added Austria to the list. The list came out last week of Netherlands and Sweden putting in cash that's already beginning the disbursement process. And we look forward to that over the next few weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, with more funding from bilateral donors. That means from governments around the world, into a trust fund that can quickly disperse to the government of Ukraine.
World Bank President David Malpass speaking at a Washington Post live event. You can see the entire event at cspan.org and on our free video app, C-SPAN Now. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Mark Warner of Virginia joined former cyber government officials to discuss Russia's cyber capabilities and the implications if cyber warfare is used against Ukraine. He also talked about if the Russia-Ukraine conflict has changed how members of the Senate work together.
I'm going to ask for a crystal ball moment. I almost saved this for last. You can dodge it if you want, but some of us have been following the CHIP Act for however long it's been in play. Is it a decade now? I don't know, but that's not fair. But has this changed the dynamics on the Hill vis-a-vis the sense that we are now in a much more immediate conflict with Russia? And I would say with China. How has it changed the dynamic?
Well, Jim, again, a great question. And not to get too grandiose here, but, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, you know, it's been tough in this country. It's been tough in the West. We went through some of the challenges of the previous president. We went through January 6th. We've seen social media break us into tribal efforts. We've all had to live through COVID. And I think at moments, and we see this reflected in our press, right? And we've obviously, where I work is sometimes dysfunctional. There's been this real question, can liberal democracy literally succeed in the 21st century? Or are these authoritarian states, and I look at China as being, you know, the kind of a economic power beyond a military power. Russia is a military power, but not much of an economic power. You know, the Chinese model has been very successful. What I think we're seeing play out in Ukraine is the Ukrainian people are literally voting with their lives to try to obtain the kind of freedom, democracy, freedom of press, things that we all take for granted. They are paying with their lives to try to have that system. So with all of our problems, I think we acknowledge we have the best system in the world. And we need to improve, but we ought to reflect a moment on that and maybe a little less internecine political warfare inside our own system would be a good sign.
Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, earlier today at a Center for Strategic and International Studies event. We heard the reference to the CHIPS Act there. That's the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors for America Act, and is aimed at helping the U.S. semiconductor industry. That entire event is also available at cSPAN.org and on the cSPAN Now video app. Indiana Republican Congresswoman Victoria Spartz is talking about her connection to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. She is the first Ukrainian-born member of the House of Representatives. Here she is yesterday on Fox News Channel.
Well, it's interesting, you know, my cousin with her daughter almost got killed by this bombing next to the Polish border. So I'm glad they were alive. You know, I suggested them to leave. So I felt, you know, good that at least they were able to get to Poland. So it's a very difficult and dire situation. But you were talking about what it will take. You know, I believe Winston Churchill mentioned that, you know, courage is one of the virtues that are important for all of the virtues. And it will take a courage from our president. You know, if you remember, he was talking about this crippling sanctions. Yeah, we did some sanctions, but they are not crippling. They squeeze Russian economy. If you really want to cripple the economy, not wait until more thousands of people are going to die, we really need to make sure that we all go to sanctions all Russian and Belarusian banks and put pressure on banks like Citibank to cease operation. We put pressure to investment bank like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan to stop managing assets of oligarchs. We're going to put pressure on publicly traded companies that, you know, to make sure they disclose their transaction in Russia and Belarus and actually delist Russian company. So there are a lot more things we can do and we need to do. If we cannot help to enforce humanitarian corridors where there are hundreds of thousands of people with no food, no water, no electricity, sick women, children sitting on the ground getting bombed, then at least we need to help to provide, you know, equipment for Ukrainians to be able to defend citizens and be able to for them to get evacuated. I think all of this things can be done, but it takes some courage. And hopefully our president is going to exercise it sooner than later.
Indiana Republican Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, the first Ukrainian-born Ukrainian-born person to serve in the House of Representatives. You can hear more from her and other members of Congress with Ukrainian connections on our latest episode of the weekly podcast. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. And finally today, First Lady Jill Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken hosted the International Women of Courage Awards ceremony at the White House. In her remarks, the First Lady briefly touched on what is happening in Ukraine.
Like all of us, my heart has ached watching videos of Ukraine. Sick kids fleeing on makeshift medical trains, the unthinkable bombing of a maternity ward, parents weeping over their children's broken bodies in the streets. The senselessness is staggering. We also know that there are horrors happening around the globe that never make the evening news. There are children's broken bodies and women who bear the scars of war all around the world. And there are women everywhere whose voices need to be heard. Because stories are powerful. They shape our lives, defining the shades of our joy and sorrow, dividing what matters from the rest. They're how we understand and connect to each other, beyond language and distance and time. They foster empathy and compel each of us to act. I continue to teach writing at a nearby community college, and in my classes, I watch students find confidence when they lay their lives down on paper. I've seen them draw closer to one another when they share, realizing that their differences are precious and their similarities infinite. The stories we tell mattered. My husband, our president, knows that. He knows how the stories he heard from survivors of abuse kept him up at night, how they inspired him to write and champion the Violence Against Women Act. He knows that their women's voices have been at the heart of resistance to tyranny, and that no country that oppresses half of its population can thrive.
The First Lady went on to discuss the importance of women telling their stories of courage and determination in the face of violence and oppression, as many of the 12 recipients of the IWOC Awards have done in their countries. You can see more from this event at cspan.org. It's also on our C-SPAN Now video app. A reminder that this program is available as a podcast. Find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.